that wise little duck can rest in the Atlantic as it heaves because he rests in the Atlantic. I never get tired of that image. Just holding it in my mind's eye for a moment causes me to breathe more deeply and slowly and calm myself a bit, to realize more than the fear that resides within. Fear, after all, is not helpful as a permanent home, as a way of being. Day to day, moment to moment even, we cannot predict what news will reach our ears and eyes that demonstrates how inhumane humans can be to one another. And is it not so that it is very easy to begin living on high alert all of the time? And when it comes to the terrorist attacks of late, it is impossible to not feel our hearts clench up in fear. Yet fear is not meant to be our permanent home. Today I want to consider how we might leave the high alert syndrome, that reality, a reality repeated over and over and over in the media, can bring to us, to consider how to rest more often in the embrace of something larger than mere fear and dread. My 20-year-old daughter, Kimberly, casually said last week on her way to a conference in Boston, "I realize that I am putting myself in danger by going to a big public event in the city." I realized that she was chronically vigilant about terrorism. After all, she was 7, and we lived 35 miles south of New York City on 9/11. We could smell and see the smoke. Her school went on lockdown. The shades were drawn. We were advised to stay where we were and not to rush to scoop up our children. We were told they would not open the doors for us if we did show up. What an odd and powerless reality as a parent, to realize that something grim and huge and deadly had just happened, that we did not know if or where or when it might continue, and we could not hold our own children in our arms. There really is nothing that terrorism can be called other than a moral travesty, that which rends humanity apart in the cruelest and most unspeakable ways. How do we understand it? What responses shall we cultivate? What conversations should we be having with one another? Is the mind of a terrorist somehow different than our own? What do you think? The reality of terrorism goes to the core understanding of who we are as human beings. There is a healing that has to happen if we are to find a better vision, if we are to continue to be a force for good in the world. Walking around chronically afraid is damaging to self and others, and is exactly the result that terrorism seeks. We liberals affirm that every human being has inherent worth and dignity. This is a difficult affirmation when looking atrocity in the face. What does affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person mean when we can watch one human beheading another on television or on YouTube? It is surely not difficult, is it, to understand the human propensity to see that terrorist as the embodiment of pure evil. It seems to me that it is almost an immediate instinct. With such a picture, I want to hide myself away from any association with such an act. But that is not our way as Unitarian Universalists. The most difficult of our 7 principles at that moment has to be we affirm that every person is inherently dignified, worthy. I think it is more, though, of a process that we must embark on from that moment on. We UUs and other liberal religions have been accused of having a very low theology of evil. That is to say, we tend to focus on the good and not address evil very deeply, very cogently, or very helpfully. So then what do you believe about evil? In much of religious mythology, evil is personified as an external force with a ghoulish countenance that roams around trying to get humans to forsake the good and embrace evil. In Genesis, Adam is tempted by the serpent, the embodiment of evil, to defy God's will. He and Eve eat the apple and are cast from the garden of perfection. I guess we've been trying to get away from that snake ever since. In Milton's Paradise Lost, Lucifer, which means, by the way, light bearer, was God's favorite angel until he challenged God's authority and was cast into hell along with his band of fallen angels. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven, boasts Satan. In hell, Lucifer becomes a liar, an empty imposter who uses boasts, spears, trumpets, and banners, as some of our national leaders seem to do. At the demonic conference in hell, in Milton's Paradise Lost, of all of the major demons, Satan is assured that he cannot regain heaven in any direct confrontation with God. However, Satan's statesman, Beelzebub, comes up with the most evil of solutions in proposing to avenge themselves against God by corrupting God's greatest creation, humankind. Many in our world and in our country, in our town, still subscribe to the idea that evil is outside of us, coaxing us. As we see this kind of thinking, creates a force beyond ourselves that we can demonize and that we can help stay safely self-righteous away from. After all, if we are the right religion, the right system of government, then we are safe in God's arms. This separates us from the self-awareness of our own ability to do evil things. Believing that we ourselves are pure and others tainted is the very culture in which oppression and victimization and terrorism grow up. Our faith asks us to go another way. What is the nature of the human being anyway? Are we born good and then corrupted by an evil society, poor parenting, living in poverty? Or are we born evil and redeemed by a good society? Before casting your ballot, consider an alternative perspective. I can only share what I have come to believe. The world is filled with good and evil. It always was, it is, it always will be, in my opinion. But not because of the devil. I agree with the Russian poet and former Gulag prisoner, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. The line dividing good and evil cuts through the center of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? He is saying each of us has the capacity to be a saint or a sinner, altruistic or selfish, gentle or cruel, dominant or submissive, perpetrator or victim, prisoner or guard. It is the reality of the nature of human beings. One only has to look at our own national history to see that this is true. It is our social circumstances that determine which of our many templates, our potentials, we develop. This makes me uncomfortable because I, of course, would never film myself lopping off someone's head, would I? We'd never do this for any reason, would we? It seems that we are seeing pure evil and that this is something that we are not. And yet we know, because we've seen the pictures from Abu Ghraib of how American soldiers treated the prisoners there. We have seen and known My Lai in Vietnam. We have known many, many years of oppression of people of color, the genocide of Native American people. So we know that in our own home, we are perfectly good people willing to provoke atrocities upon other people. What would cause a good person, a righteous person, a person who followed a religion, what would cause them to be participants in evil doings toward others? There's lots of research about this. And the most powerful way this happens is that we demonize those who we wish to have power over. If you've read, or if you haven't read, The Face of the Enemy by Sam Keen, he speaks to this as it relates to Nazi Germany. The PR program, the education, the public voice, creating a sense of non-humanity for Jews is what people rallied around, which allowed them to abuse and to violate and to kill with impunity. The power of group conformity, obedience to authority, saying all I did was unlock the door. I didn't, whatever the next step was. So chopping up one's own responsibility. And something called de-individuation, where we are made to be all of a group, not thinking for ourselves. The military does this by putting people in uniforms and shave your beard, shave your hair, and everybody looks the same. Everybody looks the same, and therefore it has an effect, research shows, on everybody acting the same. And the final way in which we ourselves could be seen as evildoers is to be bystanders and apathetic to the evil that we see. I read a lot of books for this sermon. I read about the neurology of terrorism. I read about the cultural things that have to be there for people to become terrorists. But what was most striking about most of the things I read was that people who have been influenced by their culture and dehumanization of the enemy and all those things I just mentioned can talk about how, after the fact, they were shocked that they would participate in something of such magnitude, that they became numb and became an arm of some larger vision that they could not control. So knowing that the right circumstances can cause behaviors in anyone that are vile and morally repugnant, understanding this about humanity does not in any way give a moral pass on terrorism or terrorists. Yet, when we understand that the barrier between good and evil is permeable and nebulous and often in the eye of the beholder, that we ourselves have been or could be complicit in evil, I find it liberating because I also know of my and everyone else's propensity toward the good, and it gives me hope that that person I see on YouTube has also that part of his or her humanity. Here's a little story about perception being so much of anything. A young woman was in the airport and had some time on her hands, so she bought a bag of chips and a Coke and went to sit down, and there weren't any seats. So she asked a man sitting at a table, might she sit there? He said, sure. She sat down and settled herself, and all of a sudden she saw that the man was, she opened her bag of chips, and all of a sudden the man reached in and took a chip without saying anything. She was shocked and didn't know what to do. It was awkward, and so she reached her hand in and took a chip and ate it. And he looked angry, and he looked confused too, but he then reached into the bag and took another one and ate it. And so they sat until the whole bag was finished. And as she walked to the plane, she just could not imagine what angered him so much, since she had, after all, shared her whole bag of chips with him without a word. As she buckled herself into her seat, got herself settled, reached into her bag, there were her bag of chips. Her perception of him changed. He then was the person who shared his chips with her. If you know the artist E.F. Escher, he has a wonderful rendering of one of those things you look at and you can see two different things. And it has what I see when I first look at it is all the white angels. But if you look again and focus again, you'll see that there are ghoulish-looking creatures in black also in the artwork. The strands of good and evil run within us, within our own hearts, in all hearts. This does not excuse terrorism. It only expands the context of understanding so that we might heal our world. So I've come up with, eight things maybe that are windows to a different way of living without fear. I'll share them with you. One, we can learn more. I told you I'd been reading a lot, and I learned so much that I don't think the average American knows. For instance, all but two of the major terrorist attacks in the last decade have been governments that are occupying other countries and people who feel powerless to live in their own lands in the ways that they choose. That's an interesting statistic, isn't it? So that an alleviation of terrorism might be that we stop thinking that we need to police the entire world. I also learned that most terrorists in ISIS see themselves as doing good for the world. They do not see themselves as they are so committed to the literal law of the old medieval Muslim culture that they see themselves as higher than others and creating a heaven for themselves after this life. All of these things help us to understand the minds of people who participate in ISIS. Another thing we can do is to refuse to participate in demonizing whole groups of people. Yes, it is true that the Muslim scriptures, rendered literally, are being used by ISIL to justify their actions. The research I read about terrorism says that religion is not usually the cause of terrorism, but it is almost always used to justify it, to cast others out of the saved circle and into the non-worthy-to-live circle of apostates. Listen, most Muslims denounce ISIS. That's a fact. Most Muslims do not interpret scriptures as they do. But side by side with that, we have to be aware that literal translation of scriptures is the book that ISIS is following. Three, we can put ourselves in the way of the grace that can come by interacting with people quite different than ourselves so that we learn in real time, not just in our heads as a nice principle to have, but that there is a common spark in every human being toward loving connection. This happened in the home of a friend of mine who has a 5-year-old daughter. They have not allowed her to watch television most of her life. I mean, most of the time in her life. She doesn't really know about terrorism yet. But what they have done is educated her about how people from other religions might look. So she knows if she sees a certain kind of turban and a certain dress, for instance, that it would be a Sikh or a Muslim or a Catholic or a whatever. And they were in a building in an elevator, and a Sikh man walked in with a turban, the white dress. And they had a conversation, and they helped him find his floor. And as they were all walking out of the elevator, she said to him, "Are you a Sikh?" And he was surprised that she would know it at such a young age. And he said, "Yes." And she went. We can empower our children to interact from a positive stance with people who are different from them. We can be engaged in the honing of our own minds and hearts and bodies and spirits to move away from fear. Listen, the world is not safe. That's a fact. It never was, it isn't, it never will be. We are mortal and we do wild and crazy things to one another. But that is not the whole story. All of us can hone our minds, our bodies, and our spirits to the goodness, to the higher neurological pathways. We can slow down, be out in nature, meditate, pray, get to know one another in a deeper way, bringing forth, hopefully, the better angels of our nature. We can stay engaged with human community in ways that foster connection and service, joy and hope. This is why I'm here. We're not perfect, but we have a healing vision. And for that, I live. We can vote for and speak up for people who do not immediately paint all Muslims or all Mexicans or all non-Christians or all poor people or all GLBTQ people or all black people with some kind of broad, unifying, dehumanizing brush. It won't be done perfectly, but we are called to try. We can celebrate those heroes who do stay the course and stand true to the better angels of our nature in the face of great adversity. Extremism can only be undone by a more compelling human vision. In all of these things, we make it more likely that we will be part of the evolution of a more loving world. We can't guarantee it. We can work for it. And in this work, become unafraid in the lives that we are living. Guy Finley puts it this way: "There is a storehouse of sanity, a vault of love, a treasure of kindness, all bursting at their seams. Can't you feel the pressure to just be light? Don't the walls of your heart ache to loose and open the floodgates of freedom? You have riches untold, but have lost the map to the upper regions of yourself, where you are always overflowing. So forget sometimes this world with its intermittent streams whose water begin and end. Search out the ocean and stand in her surge until the waves wash away the shores of your soul. Be not afraid, good people." Every religion says this in some way: be not afraid. The ocean of the possibility of goodness is vast and beyond our wildest dreams. May we help one another sit down in it and ride the waves, or plunge in unafraid with all trust that only visions and actions that arise out of such goodness will save the world. Rise, if you will, for hymn 122.